Good afternoon, Juno. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. Today's show is a collaboration between the Black Awareness Association of Juno and the KTOO radio station. I'm Christina Michelle, your host, and we are continuing the conversation about music in America and the influence that African Americans have had on the music industry. And we have the honor of speaking with Charles E. Dickerson III, who is the founder, executive director, and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. Earlier in today's show, we were also joined by Miss Lori Grace, who is a music teacher and the founder of Lori Grace Music and Future Stars. So we're just going to continue on with the conversation that we've had and learn more today about Mr. Dickerson's work as an orchestra conductor. And Mr. Dickerson, I would just like you to please just reintroduce yourself to our audience for those who were not with us last week, if you would.
Thanks so much. Please call me Chuck, by the way, and I hope all of you, if I ever have the joy of meeting you, there were seven Charleses in our family, and we all got different nicknames, and mine was Chuck. So I like to be referred to that way, and I hope that you will call me that, Christina,
I
particularly
will.
today. Thanks so much. So I'm Chuck Dickerson, and I am the executive director and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles and the Southside Chicago Youth Orchestra. I also am professor of orchestral studies and conducting at California State University, Dominguez Hills in the Los Angeles area. I also serve as director of music at the Rolling Hills United Methodist Church and at Leo Beck Temple, which is at the foot of Bel Air in California. Those are the titles I hold, and primarily I just tell everybody I'm a conductor. And by that, I don't necessarily mean a trained conductor. I'm an orchestra and choral conductor. That's what I do.
Wow, you are a busy man. Those are, it seems like any one of those jobs would be full time. How do you find the time to do all of them?
Well, that's kind of you to say. You just you know, when you have a passion for what you do, and I'm fortunate to be able to do work that I am passionate about. It doesn't seem like work at all. So even though I'm working late into the night at times, even perhaps composing or arranging music, it doesn't feel like I'm working at all. I'm blessed to be able to do something that I love. So yes, a lot of it consumes my time, but I still do have time to kiss my wife every once in a while and hug my children too.
Nice. I love that. Love it. Well, can you explain a little bit about what exactly an orchestra conductor does?
This seems to be a real mystery to people, and you know, a lot of orchestra conductors enjoy having that mystery about it, because then you know, you're the mysterious person in the room, and everybody kind of looks at you as like with some degree of awe, which to those of us who do this work, I honestly think it's kind of foolish, because really the work that we do is, when you look at it, think about it, it's very basic. The very first thing, the most important thing for an orchestra conductor to do is to study the music that he or she is going to conduct, and know what the score says, know what the notes are, know what instruments are to play what notes, know what dynamics are called for in the music. And by dynamics, I basically mean how loudly or how softly certain passages of music should be played, to know the articulations in the music. And by that I mean, like, well, should a particular note be played as an accent or as a staccato note, or should it be elongated, which we call a tenuto or something of that nature. The most important thing for a conductor to do is to know the score, because the second thing that the conductor then does is, the conductor stands in front of the musical ensemble and then conveys to the musical ensemble, this is how this music should be played. And 99% of the work that we do is done off stage. That doesn't mean off podium, it means off stage. So that oftentimes, when you see an orchestra conductor conducting a piece of music during a concert, all the work is pretty much done. All that a conductor can do on the podium during concert is pretty much dictate the tempo, meaning how fast or how slow something should go, to give entrances, and to some extent control the dynamic, that being how loudly or softly a bassoon should be played. But most of the work that you do is behind the scenes. It's in rehearsal. It's in preparation, so that when you're going over a certain passage, you can then explain what it is that you want the section of the orchestra, how you would have them to play it. Would you have them play it at march, da-da-da-da-da, or as a brook and a stream just flowing gently down its course? And the most important work that we do is therefore done in rehearsal. Hope that gives you a real quick overview of an orchestra.
It does. It does. Thank you so much. And I don't think that I really ever thought about how much work goes into what the conductor does before the show. Because, I mean, as someone who would be sitting in the audience, it looks like this is the main thing right here. You know, when the conductor's standing there and he's conducting, you know, and so you're like, wow, okay. But to think that, yeah, that makes sense, that really is kind of the tip of the iceberg. Like, the real work is unseen.
You know, let me give you another little analogy, if I may. Right now, the NBA finals are going on. You know, we're the coach. And just think of
how much practice
how much practice the team has to put in before they actually get out on the floor and play the game.
Got it.
It's hours and hours and hours of practice and learning certain plays. Yep. So to speak, a basketball team would run, or a football team would run, or batting practice for a baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
How many hours does a baseball player put into just hitting pitches in practice ready for a game? Well, that's what we do in the music world. We put in hours and hours of practice and rehearsal and preparation for concert.
I love that analogy. That really brings it home for me, and hopefully for our listeners too. Thank you. So can you tell us what instruments are played in the orchestra, and on average, how many people tend to be in an orchestra?
Well, now this is going to be kind of a long answer, so get ready.
Okay.
There are basically four families of instruments that are in the orchestra. They're the woodwinds, they're the brasses, there's the percussion, and they're the strings. Now, those are the four families, but the families all have subgroups. For example, in the woodwinds, you basically have four groups of woodwinds. You have flutes, you have oboes, you have clarinets, and you have bassoons.
Okay.
Generally, in an orchestra, you're only going to have two oboes, but sometimes you'll have a derivative instrument from the oboe, an English horn, which is very much like an oboe. So you might have an alto flute, you might have a piccolo, that's in the flute family. In the clarinets section, oftentimes you have a bass clarinet line. Sometimes you have what's called an E-flat clarinet played. And then in the bassoon family, generally you have either the bassoon or the contrabassoon. So although there's only four families in the woodwind family of instruments, each of those families have subgroups. A saxophone is also a woodwind instrument, by the way, and saxophones, however, are not generally written for for orchestral work. That's the woodwinds. But in the brasses, then we have another four groups. We have horns, which were commonly known as French horns for many years, but the common word today is we just call them horns.
Okay.
We have trumpets, we have trombones, and we have tubas. And then there are derivations of those. For example, you might have an alto trombone. You might have a bass trombone. That gives you an example of how you also break out some of these families. In the percussion family, that is a family that is there's no limit to what kind of instruments you can have. A piano is technically part of the percussion section because we think of percussion as anything that is sounded by you actually hitting something.
Yes.
Clapping can be percussive.
Yes.
Snapping your fingers is percussive. And so chimes are percussive. Cymbals are percussive. Timpani are percussive. Snare drums are percussive.
Okay.
And there are so many different kinds of drums. And then the major part of the orchestra is made up by the strings. And generally you have four kinds of strings, but you have five sections of strings in an orchestra.
Okay.
The four kinds of strings are the violins, the violas, the cellos, and the basses.
Okay.
But generally, in the violins in an orchestra, you have first violins and second violins. So generally, in an orchestra, you have five lines that the strings play. First violin part, second violin part, viola part, cello part, and bass part. So that makes up an orchestra. Now, generally, when you are about to perform, or in most orchestras, let's go back to the woodwinds, you usually have two woodwinds per family. You have two oboes, you have two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, and two bassoons. Now, there are obviously derivations of that, or else there wouldn't be these other instruments. Sometimes you'll have three or four flutes and sometimes a piccolo. Sometimes you'll have two or three, you'll have more than two bassoons. You might have three plus maybe even a contrabassoon. But generally, in a classic orchestra, you have two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, and two bassoons. In the brass section, you generally have four horns, either two or three trumpets, depending on what the score calls for, generally two trombones, and more today you have a bass trombone in the brass section. So you have 9, 10, 11 players in your brass section. Sometimes you'll also have a tuba, depending on what the score calls for. Once again, in the percussion section, now in the classic music, in the days of Haydn, who lived in the 1700s and 1800s and is considered the father of the symphony, the only percussion instrument he wrote for was the timpani.
Mm-hmm.
But in today's world, like with George Gershwin playing his music, he's got so many different kinds of percussive instruments that can be unlimited. But generally in an orchestra, you're going to have two or three people who are back there playing the percussion. In a standard orchestra, in terms of the strings, this is where you have the most people in the orchestra. Generally, you have 16 first violins, 14
wow.
second violins,
wow.
12 violas, 10 cellos, and 8 basses. So basically, you have about 60 to 64 string players. And total in the orchestra, you're going to have somewhere between 80 and 90 when you take in the 8 woodwinds, 9 or 10 brasses, 2 or 3 percussion, and somewhere between 60 and 65 generally in terms of the strings. So that's how many people are in an orchestra.
Wow.
Now, that was a long answer and a lot of information there. If you have further questions about it, feel free or we can move on. Either one.
I don't have any further questions at the moment. That actually really answers it thoroughly. I had no idea how many people were actually in an orchestra. I never really thought about it. I think the only time I've seen an orchestra play live might have been at the Lion King at the Pantages.
Okay.
And I don't remember.
Let me make a comment on that, if I
sure.
may.
Yeah.
What you saw, if you went to the Lion King, is you saw what's called a pit orchestra.
Yes.
You didn't, yeah. And that's going to be distinguished from a symphonic orchestra.
Got
what
it.
I've described for you is a symphonic orchestra.
Okay.
So if you go down to a concert hall and you want to hear a Beethoven symphony or a Bruckner symphony or a Sibelius symphony, you're going to have the kind of instrumentation that I just gave to you.
Got
However,
it.
For Broadway shows, you're basically going to have a pit orchestra of about 20 to maybe 25 performers. The string section is so much smaller, and generally people who write for Broadway, most Broadway productions, the focus is on the singers and the instrumentation is used as accompaniment, and so therefore oftentimes it is less complex and much smaller.
Makes sense.
So that's probably that would explain why what you saw at the Lion King was so much smaller.
Got it. Wow, thank you very much. Well, in preparation for today's discussion, you and I had a conversation last week, and you explained some of the history of segregated African-American classical musicians, their struggles to be merged with their white counterparts, their difficulties winning auditions, and so forth. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about this subject?
Thank you for that invitation. I'd be happy to do so. Traditionally, African-Americans did not play in American orchestras. If you think of some of the grand orchestral scores that you've heard, for example, the music to Gone with the Wind, the music to Lawrence of Arabia, huge, beautiful orchestral music. However, there were not any African Americans playing in those orchestras. And the reason was not because we couldn't, not because we didn't have the ability, but because there was a pretty strict code of segregation, particularly during those times, that existed impacted our inability to play. We African Americans then took it upon ourselves to try to break into the industry, because frankly, a lot of the money that was being made by the orchestral players who played in those grand scores was much more than what African American musicians were making. And as a matter of fact, in Los Angeles, there was a union. There is a union, the Musicians Union, Local 47, which up until the 60s was segregated, and only white players would get the opportunities to play the great scores in the Hollywood studios, and the black musicians specifically could not. The union made it clear that there was a reason why they thought that African Americans should not be given the opportunity to play in the Hollywood studios, and that was number one. We didn't, quote, have ensemble experience, meaning that we hadn't played in orchestras before, and so therefore, why should we be permitted in now? And number two, that we didn't know the repertoire. So there's a little history here that I'd like to share with your listeners, Christina.
Please.
In 1948 in Los Angeles, an African-American music teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District, Miss Edith Gunn, began an orchestra in Los Angeles called the Southeast Symphony. And that symphony was created by her and other African-American music teachers specifically to create a place where black musicians could learn ensemble performance and could learn the repertoire, the Beethoven symphonies, the Schubert symphonies, the Mozart symphonies, etc. That organization still exists to this day, although its original purpose being to train African Americans to have the opportunity to play in the Hollywood studios, is not as prevalent today because the doors are now open. Mm-hmm. Segregation has pretty much been eliminated, but we still have such a small representation within that industry because, regrettably, it requires so much commitment, monetary commitment, as well as time commitment, that parents who oftentimes see their young people growing up steer them in other directions because they realize that the chances of them making it in that world are so small. But anyway, so the Southeast Symphony began in 1948, and it continues to this day. Even to this day, I don't know if you're going to play, if your listeners, rather, heard our conversation previously, but even today, our numbers, African-American numbers and Latino numbers, are extremely small in terms of our representation in the workforce of American orchestras. And that's because it's the legacy of segregation still hovers over our industry. We're hopeful that more and more African-Americans and Latinos will win auditions to American orchestras. As a matter of fact, my organization, the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, sponsors the Los Angeles Orchestra Fellowship, which is funded for us by the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and we're thankful to them for that. I had to give them a shout-out there, forgive me. But what we specifically do is we are training young, emerging professional musicians of color, primarily African-Americans and Latinos, to prepare to take and win auditions in American orchestras. This is still a very difficult challenge within our community, but it's one that we are taking head on, and we hope to be able to change those numbers so that hopefully American orchestras begin to look more like all of America. Yeah. That was a long answer, but there you go.
It's just this topic that we really don't know that we need to be discussing more often, and so I'm glad that we have the opportunity to today. And
thank you for it too, Christina. Thank you.
Absolutely. In my research, I read that it's rare to see more than one or two black musicians in a symphony orchestra. And you mentioned last week that I think you said blacks make up approximately 1 or 1.5% of a classical orchestra, and Latinos are somewhere around 2.5%.
That's right. African Americans make up 1.8% of the workforce of American orchestras, and Latinos make up 2.5% of the workforce of American orchestras. Although both African Americans and Latinos are approximately 13% of the American population. So the difference between 13% and 1.5% is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess if I were to think about it, I've noticed that, but I just always assumed that there wasn't much interest on our part. And so that's my ignorance. I had no idea about the barriers to getting auditions and things of that nature.
Well, yes, there is huge interest in the African American community of playing classical music.
Yeah.
Classical music is really the foundation of just about all kinds of music that you learn. And when you go to take a piano lesson when you're very young, your teacher doesn't start you by playing jazz.
That's right.
Your teacher doesn't start you by playing rock and roll or hip hop. Your teacher starts you with the fundamentals, and the fundamentals are based on the classical traditions, the classical genres. So everybody who's a musician, I'll say just about everybody who's a musician, there's some people who are musicians, if it's fair to call them musicians, but who don't have really the training. But those who have the training, all of that training is based on the classical principles and the classical traditions. And so therefore, I would say the vast majority of musicians, whether they're black, white, orange, purple, or green, all of them have some foundation in the classical tradition. And as a consequence, African Americans, just like anybody else, aspire to become professional classical musicians.
Wow. I'm just blown away by this, because it is such a, it's a, an esteemed position. I'm learning to be part of an orchestra, and of course to be the conductor. It really is. It's something that's very, very special. And I'm wondering.
Let me make a comment on that point.
Okay.
About the conducting part.
Yes.
The numbers of African American conductors are even less than the numbers of African Americans in the orchestra.
Mm.
I would ask everybody, your listeners, to close your eyes and just think for a moment. Every time you've seen an orchestra, have you ever even seen anybody black or a person of color or a woman, for that matter,
wow,
standing in front of the orchestra conducting? Generally, most people think of an older white man.
That's right.
As an orchestra conductor. Well, doggone it, all of us who know this music and love it and want to do that kind of work, all of us aspire to be on that podium, whether it's regardless of the color of your skin or your background or your ethnicity or your gender. And there are just as many capable people of other races, of other ethnicities, of other genders, or gender identities, I'll say, who are capable of serving as orchestra conductors.
Yeah. So you're kind of like a pioneer in this area, it seems.
Well, pioneer, I don't know. I thank you for that. But the first person who ever in the United States who ever conducted the first African American to ever conduct a major orchestra in the United States was William Grant Still, who's primarily known as a composer, but he also did some conducting. He conducted the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl in 1932, I believe it was. And that was the first time that that we're on record that we know of as having an African-American actually serve as a conductor of a major American orchestras. We have a few now who are employed as conductors in their orchestras. Michael Morgan is an African-American who conducts the Oakland Symphony. Rodney Cox is an African-American who serves as the associate conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra. And you can find a few more from there, but we are very, very rare.
Wow. Wow. Well, if you're just tuning in today, we are having a conversation with Chuck Dickerson, who is an African-American director and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. And we're just going to take a break really quick and go to commercial. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation. Good afternoon, and we are back from commercial break. This is your producer, Christina Michelle. I am here moderating today's show. We have a guest, Chuck Dickerson. He's joining us via Zoom from Los Angeles, California, and Chuck is the founder, executive director, and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. And we are just going to continue on with the very informative conversation that we've been having about classical music and the role that Blacks and other races have played in it, and more specifically, have not played in it, and some of the barriers to being part of this genre that African Americans have and are experiencing. Chuck, can you tell us, what are the most coveted positions in the orchestra? You've already explained in detail what the orchestra consists of, which I didn't know that orchestras were so large and that there were so many instruments played. But in such an elaborate grouping, I would wonder if there are coveted positions, and if so, what are they?
Well, yes, there are coveted positions. They are not, this is not something that people talk about a lot, but everybody seeks to be in the first chair.
Okay.
Now, in the orchestra, generally, the first chair of the first violin section is called the concert master, or when there is a woman, you might call her the concert mistress.
Okay.
But either way, that is the person who is thought of oftentimes as the conductor's, almost like the conductor's assistant.
Okay.
In today's modern world, there are assistant conductors, associate conductors, who also participate and are hired by the bigger orchestras. You're in Alaska. I don't know if there's an orchestra in Juneau. I know that there's a major U.S. orchestra in Seattle, which might be the closest to you.
Okay.
They have not only their principal conductor, but they also have associate conductors. But within the orchestra itself, I mentioned to you before, there are 16 first violins.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first violinist is the concert master. Well, there's also a what we call a principal position for every single instrument. So in the second violin section, although you generally would have 14 to 16 players, generally 14 players, there's going to be a lead, and that lead is the person who sits in the front row, the first person at the first music stand. That's the principal second violinist. You'd have a principal violist, a principal cellist, a principal bass player, a principal hornist, a principal trumpet, a principal trombonist, a principal oboe, principal flute, principal clarinet, principal bassoon, and a principal percussion player. And by the way, oftentimes in most major orchestras, you distinguish the timpanist from other orchestra percussion players, and that's because the timpani is pretty much a classical fixture in the classical orchestra, whereas many of the other percussion instruments are not. But there is a principal, a lead in each of these sections of the orchestra, and there's two things why it's more prestigious. Number one, they are looked to as the leader, like the captain of their team,
okay,
so to speak. And number two, generally they are paid more.
Got
so
it.
If you become the principal of a section in an orchestra, you're generally being paid. The first flautist is being paid more than the second flautist, generally.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. And so before we started talking about this, I was wondering if we saw African Americans in these positions less, but now knowing what I know from what you've already shared, we're not seeing them in the orchestra hardly at all. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding that, I can identify at least for you right now one person who I know of who is a principal who's African American, and in an important and major U.S. orchestra. That is Anthony McGill.
Okay.
He is the principal clarinetist in the New York Philharmonic. He is the only African American in that orchestra, but he is also the principal clarinetist. There are other principals around. I just frankly can't identify them right now,
wow,
but because there's so few and so rare.
Yeah.
I know a guy who's in Atlanta. Oh, Alex Lang. Alex Lang is the principal clarinetist of the Phoenix Symphony.
Okay.
These are very, very few.
Yeah.
Far between.
In your opinion, what was different for them? How do you think that they got the opportunity that they got to be in the orchestra and then to also be principals? We're talking about, thousands of musicians in a classical orchestra across the United States, and we're hard pressed to name more than, four or five African Americans, especially principals. What do you think has been different for them? And I know that's probably a hard question to answer, but if you were to guess, what might you say?
This is not a guess.
Okay.
This is not a guess at all.
All right.
I refer to this as the Jackie Robinson syndrome. When Branch Rickey wanted to integrate Major League Baseball, he didn't go out and find just some journeyman ball player that was going to sit on the bench. He had to go out and find a person who he thought perhaps was even the best, so that he could immediately promote that person to the major leagues, and that person would be a star. And in fact, that's what Jackie Robinson was. Well, the same still, that phenomenon still plays itself out in so much of American society. An African American can't just be as good as somebody else who's going to perhaps be the president of the bank, or who's going to perhaps be superintendent of the education system in a particular city. You've got to shine yourself a little bit beyond just the best.
Absolutely.
And that, I think, has been the case with Anthony and the case with Alex. They've had to demonstrate not only are they capable, but they are so far so shiny of an object that as the freight train drives by, you kind of have to stop and pick up that shiny object and say, okay, well, gosh, that piece of gold there glitters a little bit more brightly.
Yeah.
So let's bring that person on, and then let's bring that person on to be our principal.
Yeah.
I will also share with you that there is an effort in the American orchestra industry right now to try to do a better job of diversity,
okay,
of diversifying its personnel. And in that respect, I think there is really an attempt to try to actually be deliberate about finding people who are not just white, but people of color, women, and et cetera, other people who represent diversity, so that American orchestras can start to look a little bit more like America, so that American orchestras won't die.
Yeah.
Because if they – think of this. Much of the music that American orchestras play is composed by dead white people.
Yeah.
Just like if you look on a dollar bill, same thing. What we have on our currency, dead white people. Well, there was talk for a minute about trying to Harriet Tubman on one of the dollar bills as an effort to demonstrate more diversity of the American world.
Yes.
That has been stopped by the current administration.
Okay.
But that same principle holds true beyond just the dollar bill. In American orchestras, we play primarily the music of dead white people. We're trying to change that. And if we continue to do that, American audiences are going to shrink, and we're not going to be able to attract people to our concert halls. And as a consequence, American orchestras would ultimately die.
Mm.
So American orchestras, they're not stupid. They understand that there is a need for them to diversify so that perhaps they will attract people to come to the concert hall to see the Anthony McGills, to see the Alex Lang, to see the guy in Minnesota, the Cox, the conductor, so that people will understand, yeah, there are people like me up there on that stage. Let me go and support them.
Yes. So I can see what you're saying about Anthony McGill and Alex Lang and how they had to be not good, not great, but they had to be the best. They had to be a little bit better than great,
Right.
I'm wondering, How finances typically play a role when it comes to blacks and classical music and getting into that. And in our last show, Miss Lori had actually mentioned that there's a problem sometimes with having musicians or having instruments available to practice and to play with at home. Do you see this in classical as well?
To become a classical instrumentalist costs a lot of money.
Got it.
And I'm going to be, I try to be as clear about this and make this example as best as I can. To win an audition in American Orchestra, you have to be extraordinarily good. And I liken this to LeBron James.
Okay.
LeBron James, I don't know this to be a fact, but I'll bet you he had a basketball in his hands when he was 3 and 4 years old. So that he's able to perform magic practically with that basketball. I mean, that's how Magic Johnson got his name. He was performing magic, or his nickname, I should say. He was performing magic with the basketball. Well, the same is true, I think, in any discipline. And the younger you start to understand and have an opportunity to participate in a particular trade, the better you are at. There's no mystery to the fact that Bach's sons were fantastic musicians. They grew up in a home where there was music around them. All right. I'm going to the issue of finances.
Okay.
With regard to the cost of preparing to become a musician that is good enough to play in an American orchestra, you've got to start your training at a very early age. I had my first piano lesson when I was 3 years old.
Okay.
Well, that cost my parents money because they had to pay for me to have piano lessons. I took piano lessons from the time I was 3 until I was 12. That's 10 years. I know the 3 and the 2, but yeah, right. It was 10 years of piano lessons that I really had. And my parents had to pay for those piano lessons. They also had to pay to have a piano in the house.
Yeah.
Well, even if you want to just play a flute, you've got to buy a flute or get access to a flute. That's going to cost you money. Then, as you get older and start to prepare more and more, just as I was explaining earlier, the argument was that we didn't have experience in ensemble playing. Well, now what you want to do is you want to start getting your children involved in ensembles at an early age.
Okay.
For example, if you wanted your child to become a ballerina, you're going to take that child to a ballet class, and there where you're going to be where that child is going to be trained with other up aspiring ballerinas. So you got to pay to get them in those classes, just like Little League baseball.
Yeah.
You want your child to play Little League baseball, you got to pay for them to have that team experience. Same is true with musicians. Now, if you've learned your instrument well enough, now you've got to go and find an orchestra to play in. And when you're young, you can go and find a youth orchestra to play in. They rarely exist in African American and Latino communities. As a matter of fact, my orchestra, the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, that's my primary orchestra, we specifically exist in the African American community of Los Angeles to give young people in that community the opportunity to play in ensemble. Because if they didn't play in my orchestra, they'd have to go to outlying areas. That's going to cost their parents money to
Yes.
get them there. It's going to cost them time in terms of just the accessibility of getting to places like that. And so it is not an inexpensive venture. And then once you get really good, now you're going to need specialized lessons. And the cost of those specialized lessons is extremely expensive. $100 to $200 to $300 an hour is not
Oh,
uncommon
wow.
to have a lesson with someone who is a professional in a 1 hour lesson
Oh, my
in
goodness.
someone who's plays for an orchestra. So it is an expensive venture.
Wow, and how many lessons would you say if we're talking about specialized lessons, several hundred dollars an hour, how many would you say are needed, like a week or a month? Or would it be something that you almost like a consultant, like you'd maybe have one lesson, in a month or 2 or 3 months, and then you continue on your own?
My dear friend Alex Lang, who I've referred to earlier, who is the principal clarinetist of the the Phoenix Symphony, I'll bet you Alex still takes lessons.
Yeah.
I'll bet you he still goes and finds, particularly he's got a piece of music he's got to prepare for the orchestra. I'll bet you, Alex, I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet, knowing Alex as I do, mm-hmm. I would bet you he goes and consults with another clarinetist, probably a master teacher, so to speak,
yes.
and pays a couple $100 for an hour of instruction easily. And he's at the top of his game.
Yeah.
So for those who are still aspiring to get there, it's impossible to tell you how many hours you need to put in to make. There's an old saying. people ask, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the answer is practice, 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 and oftentimes that practice, practice, practice is done with the assistance of a teacher, teacher, teacher,
yes.
and that costs money, money, money.
Good answer. Whew, goodness, this is deep. This is much more than I ever knew, and I believe that our listeners are learning just as much as I am here.
I hope so.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm going to ask this question. Should parents of Black children prepare their children differently if they are interested in learning classical music? And you've already touched on this a little bit, saying that they need to start early.
I'm not sure if I know what you mean by differently, though.
Well, I guess I should say, in other words, are there challenges or stereotypes that they should prepare their children to expect? So outside of finances and being ready to invest heavily financially, is there a certain mindset that they need to have or that they need to train their children to have in order to really be successful in this industry?
I have two parts to get to that answer.
Okay.
First part has nothing to do with ethnicity, race, or whatever.
Okay.
I think every parent should teach their children music, and there's reasons why, whether they want their children to aspire to be professional musicians or not. And that's because so many principles of life can be taught and learned through music.
Mm.
For example, all music has a rhythm. Life has a rhythm.
Yes.
You can learn the rhythm of life through music. Music has dynamics, that is loudness and softness. There are times in life when it's appropriate to be loud. You learn how to be loud and how to make that loudness beautiful through music. There's times to be soft in music. There's times to be soft in life. And music, I think there's no better way to teach a person how to be soft and yet beautiful and yet important and be quiet about it.
Mm.
You learn this music. You learn that there are times when you have the melody and it's time for you to step up and to speak up. There are times when you have the harmony, when you are in a supporting role. There's hardly any better discipline to learn these kinds of things about life than in music. And that applies to all persons. I don't care what your ethnicity is. With respect to people who are African-American and other minorities, I think there is a second dynamic, and that is, yes, you still need to be able to know that the industry is still an industry that is not as open as we would yet like it to be in the American ideal. But, you know, you learn that as an African-American, you learn that anyway, whether you're in music or any other discipline, and that's probably true. That I'm sure American indigenous Americans learn that, you know, you gotta be bad, you gotta present yourself in an appropriate way in order to try to break through a barrier that is oftentimes put up in front of you because of your ethnicity or your color or your race.
Excellent answer. Thank you. Thank you. And I love that, what you said about the rhythm and just what music has to teach us about life. So that's so important.
There's a time to be the soloist.
There's a time to be the soloist.
There's a time to be in the ensemble.
Yeah. Beautiful. I love that analogy. So we're going to just go ahead and pause for a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we are going to hear from our guest, Chuck Dickerson, on what's next for him and how our listeners can connect with and support his organization. We'll be right back. Good afternoon, Juno, and welcome back to today's show, which is a collaboration of the Black Awareness Association of Juno and KTOO. And we have had the absolute pleasure and honor of hearing from Chuck Dickerson today, who's the founder, executive director, and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. Chuck, we've learned so much from you today, and I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to have had this time with you. I'm wondering, is there anything else that you would like to share that we haven't touched on today?
I would just encourage all of your listeners to take your children to an orchestral concert. Yes. Do it as much as you can. Some of you might not have a real love for orchestral music. Nevertheless, I don't know what the Juno Symphony is doing, but find it. Look it up. There's a youth orchestra in Juno I know as well. Look them up. And take your children to go hear the orchestra. Call the executive director and ask, can you have your child come and actually sit in a rehearsal to see how things work, to sit at the foot of a conductor and watch to see what a conductor does. I encourage everybody to have that experience. And all you got to do is pick up the phone and say, hey, I am X. I'd like to come see you. May I? And 99 times out of 100, they're going to say, hey, come on. We'd be glad to have you. I encourage everybody to do that.
Fantastic.
As for myself, my objective before I lay down for the last time is to try to increase the knowledge of orchestral music in African-American communities around the country. I have a little bit of a mantra, and that is wherever there's an NFL team, there needs to be an inner city youth orchestra. I've said before that there are youth orchestras around the country, but very few. In fact, ours, the two that I operate in Los Angeles and Chicago are the only two that I know that operate specifically in communities of color. And we do that so that we can increase awareness and increase the capability and the ability of those who are within those communities to participate. And if you'd like to know more about our orchestra and our efforts in this regard, please check out our website. We have a website at www.icyola. That's Inner City Youth Orchestra Los Angeles. And as I said, we also now are running the Southside Chicago Youth Orchestra. And, you know, before I lay down, I want to make sure that there are youth orchestras in Dallas, in Atlanta, in Pittsburgh, in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, you name it, San Francisco, Denver, even Juno.
Yes.
So that young people can learn this genre of music and take with them the excellence of person that you become by being a musician, by learning to play something excellently, by learning the discipline of practice, by learning the discipline of perfection and what it takes to be perfect at doing something over and over and over again until you become an expert at it. I'm hopeful that all of your listeners will check out our website, and if they are committed to this kind of an effort, so that we can create more of these kinds of institutions in our communities, there is a place there where you can actually donate. I don't mean this to be a commercial, but we do accept donations because there's such a need to teach our young people in our country how to pursue excellence, and that's ultimately what we're about.
Excellent. Wow. Thank you so much, Chuck. It's been
such an honor. I'm grateful for this opportunity to share with you today, Christina, and with your listeners there in Juno. I wish you all good listening and good music.
Thank you so much. And to our listeners, again, we will have all of the information to contact Chuck and to support his organization on our website. I'm sorry, on our Facebook, which you can find us at Black Awareness Association of Juno on Facebook. And again, the website for Chuck's organization is icyola.org. Thank you so much, Chuck, and have a wonderful rest of your afternoon.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.